Today's scripture reading is quite shocking. It's one of those famous doomsday tales, which doesn't really, kind of resonate with the loving, merciful God at all. Especially this one is against people of Egypt. What did they do wrong in that context? Well, you need to understand, however, this person, Ezekiel, right now is sitting in Babylonia, and his kingdom was gone, his temple was gone. A whole doom fell upon his people, and he has lost all hope. So only hope is in God in this time, in this age. If you look into this last end of this kingdom of Judah and how they fell, that they tried to fight against this famous kingdom called Babylon by kind of holding hands with the king of Egypt. The king of Egypt was not powerful enough. So that was actually the second strike against Jerusalem, which caused the total destruction. Interestingly, this small little kingdom we know as kind of Judah or Israel, this is located in between three superpowers, or more likely two superpowers. One in the east, one in the south. One in the east is kind of Persian territory. And, from the ancient times, they have this kingdom called Babylon, and this is Neo-Babylon. And in the north side, they have Assyria, which kind of happened once or twice. And then the south side is the very traditional long-term superpower called Egypt. But this kingdom was located in between in these superpowers. And their fate was basically decided by how these powers somehow come upon, or how they rise and fall. But this time, in Ezekiel's time, Israel, it was all gone. All gone. The northern kingdom was already destroyed. Southern kingdom destroyed. Their strong castle, this walled city, Jerusalem, was totally torn apart. Even their temple, sanctuary, was destroyed. So if you're a human being, if you're Ezekiel sitting in this place and thinking about your people and trying to have a hope, you may have a kind of dual mind. It doomed to us, it should doom to everybody. Why not just, why not for everybody? Why just for us? What did we do wrong in a way? These superpowers, they just attack people. Is it really fair in a way? But at the same time, that's not what the story is about. It's about he wants to give his people hope. There should be a day coming. In that day, we may regain something that we have lost. And God is giving us this promise. And that's where in here saying, in that day. And if you read prophets, there's so many of this, on that day. What day? They don't really mention it. But on that day, when God is in full charge, the truthful part is that on that day, God will be fully in charge of everything on earth. Everything on earth will not allow any injustice at all. On that day. And on that day, the people of Israel will come back to their own land, reveal their lost capital, rebuild their temple, and reunite on that day. But that's on that day. That's one of the times that you see in the Old Testament. So, do you know what time is? What is time? I kind of tried to understand that myself, and I got lost in the middle. Where when they were talking about nowadays, we measure the second by, atomic way, that there's acium radiation that kind of goes around some, how many times, I don't know, 9 billion times and some 100 million times of something. We call that 1 second. We somehow live in this basic concept and believe that we all have time. So it is not awkward to ask anybody that, do you have time? Then your answer either is, yes, I got 5 minutes, or no, I don't. Sounds like you have time. Now the question is, do you? Do you really have time? I mean, do you really have time as something that is object that can be somewhat quantified in a way of saying that I got 5 minutes or I got 10 minutes? Or how much of time do you have for yourself to be in the way you are? 50 years more? 100 years? Do we really have time? That was the question that was I was trying to find an answer in this inquiry of reading all kind of scientific, religious, philosophical explanations about time. And somehow in here, Jesus is saying, your time and my time are different. Quite interesting, isn't it? Your time will be always here. My time hasn't come yet. Or it's not fully come. Or it's not completed yet. But there is somewhat God's time and human time. Scientifically speaking, a lot of scientists, I believe including Isaac Newton, they wanted to define time as something that's absolute. So that, I mean, there's a, one of my favorite movie was about time machines. So fun, you know, you can move back the time and you can do this fun, you can meet your mom and dad when they're really young. Kind of cool thing. Back to the Future was one of my favorite movies when I was young. Like, yes, if I can have the time machine. That theory kind of is developed based on this belief that time is like an everlasting movie in a way. That it started at a certain point, it goes to eternity into an angle. So that if your presence is here, but somehow you can alter reality or do something, you can move backward here. Because it exists there too. And even more, or even forward. Because this thing, as objective reality, exists. Interesting. And Immanuel Kant kind of saying, no, time and spaces are not really real. They're all conceptual and subjective. It depends on how you perceive it. And then if you go to religion, Buddhism saying, it's all illusion. It's creation of your mind. Yet still, we all have watches and clocks and iPhones and cell phones and, you know, wall clocks and and we set alarms, right? Yeah, in the morning, well, I want to get up 6 a.m., 4 a.m., 9 a.m. You know, we all schedule it that way. And even we try to modify our life in that way. And sometimes we want to save our time or even spend our time wisely, efficiently. As if time is something that is really objectively real. Or is time something that you feel the way it is? So, yes, they're both sides always. Just like our hands touches water and our hands touches the water. That's one side of reality. But there's another side of reality that tells you something else. The water you touch brings a memory of your father, mother, or sometimes it brings the fear that you drowned. You're almost drowned when you're young. It brings fear in your body. So for some people, touching water brings good memory. It feels good. That's real. But some people, it's fear. It's fearful. That's another real. But still, your hand is touching water. That's real too. So the kind of conclusion I was getting into that was when Jesus was saying time, maybe he was talking about reality. What is real to you is not exactly same as what is real to me. Well, what is real to me is not exactly same as what is real to you. Do you have time? Yes. Nowadays, that question is actually asking either you have how many minutes. Like, do you have 10 minutes, 15 minutes? You got an hour for worship this morning, so you came here, which is a great choice. Does that mean that the people who did not make it didn't have an hour to come here? Not necessarily. So when we're asking the time questions of either you have time, it's not really about time question, is it? It is about your priority, your principles, your choices. What's more important to you? When you're reading a book, you really love the book. This part is a really important part. Your son or daughter comes. Dad, Mom, play with me. You got time for that? Or not? What would you tell? Oh, give me 10 more minutes. I have to finish this book. Or would you close the book and go play 10 minutes and come back? If you are really thinking time in objective way of saying, like, can you make 1 hour per week for worship? I believe almost 99.9% of people will say yes. You ask this question, can you do it every week? Not really. Why not? So it's not about time. It's never about time. It's never about 10 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. It is about your focus in reality, that where you dwell in, where you're connected to. So your mind moves toward the place that you like. And what is real for you is more important to you. For example, that example again, when this mother or dad, reading the story, the seeing the next page is really important because the mind is fully engaged in this story. Well, that's real at that moment. Nothing else is really real. Why? Mind is fully engaged in here. So daughter and son comes nearby and waving hands, you don't see them because your mind is in here. Same thing can apply to work. Same thing can apply to anything. So when God is saying, there is my time and there's your time, does that mean that God's saying that, hey, you and I are different, so you live there, I live here? If that's the case, we shouldn't have New Testament. The New Testament is about God taking human form, living in human world. In a way, living in human time, yet living in God's time at the same time. What that means is that we can, if we choose to, live in God's time. Or, more truthfully, if there is no God's time that is connected to us, we don't exist. So having that in your mind, now if you read Ezekiel again, of course it's not about killing people and destroying a nation. There's no reason to do that. As a matter of fact, if you read very carefully all the prophecies in the New Old Testament, you can pinpoint that only a few things actually happened the way it was prophesied. Only a few things. Like Jerusalem, like sanctuary. They're totally destroyed. But not all the people were killed. They were simply captured and carried away to other countries. So it was not about dooming nations or killing people. Now, what is it about? The key point, key word in this prophecy against Egypt, it begins with the line saying the pride of Egypt. Egypt was proud of its might. And if you put Swedenborg's correspondences a little bit into this, this is our pride in our knowledge, our knowing. We believe we are almighty because we know everything. Sometimes we believe that we have solutions for everything because we know everything, or we can know everything. We have knowledge. Feels like, hey, I know this, I can do this. Truth is, not really. A lot of times, knowing means being able to do. That was the case in the ancient time, probably until 1950s or 40s. But nowadays, knowing does not mean at all being able to do. Knowing simply means you have knowledge in your brain that may not be real to you. So, when this is said, it is about warning to us that when the time comes, we have much, much more knowledge. These days, actually, even if you're super genius in the world, you cannot learn everything. It's impossible. But even back in the Swedenborg's days, if you're super genius, yes, you can learn everything. Because basically, if you read about 500 books, that's basically about that's all that there is about. 500 books. But nowadays, you have to read, what, 5 billion books? Also printed in how many languages? 150 languages? It is impossible. Yet there is this pride in our mind that simply because I know this, I am able to do this. Or, in a more dangerous case, I am doing this because I know this. In this New Testament, the conversation is supposedly happening between Jesus and his brothers. If you really read it carefully, his brothers are kind of, what it says here is that they're not believing in him. But if you read it in another aspect or angle, what they are saying is they're giving him actually sort of practical advice. Okay, Jesus, you got the power, you got the message. You know how to, kind of influence the people. If you have an agenda, if you want to make something new, go for it. Go public. That's what they are saying to him. In a way, if you read the whole Gospels, Jesus never really went in public about his message. If it shocks you, kind of check it out. He never really went to temple and actually gave his message there in front of everybody and kind of challenging the priests and scribes. He never really officially confronted the authority. Kind of confronted them in a side way. He criticized the Pharisees a lot, but he never really went into actual argument with them. So whole his kind of ministry, he was doing it, you know, sideways. Most of them happening in Galilee, not in Judea. Why? Was he coward? Was he afraid? We don't think so, right? And what was the reason that he was doing all those things, you know, kind of sideways and outside, you know, as described by his own brother, saying in secret? The mission of Jesus was not so much about convincing people. In a more deeper, more spiritual mission he was having. And I was reading this passage probably quite many times, and one aspect just came into me, again, a new aspect. I never thought about it that way before. Is that maybe this whole ministry that we're reading, stories about Jesus, actually he was doing it because he had a compassion for the people. But that was not the main part of his mission or the goal that he wants to achieve. He is always talking about his time has not been completed or fully come. The real mission Jesus was carrying out, according to many theologians, including Swedenborg, was that he was fighting against the sum of all evils that it has been stored up by all humanity since the beginning of human beings. And that was his real mission. The power of the evil that human beings somehow stored was overwhelming, too much to humans to overcome. In a way of saying that choosing evil has become, or being selfish has become more innate condition to them. But they didn't feel any bad about being selfish in that context. So, what Jesus was actually doing by taking a human form and living on earth was actually fighting all those evils one by one, and restoring what we call the universal order back into the way it's supposed to be. And the result was giving us this freedom to choose, freedom of choice back again, so that we can truly be the beings who can choose what to do regarding good and evil. So being a good person, being an evil person, it's got to be your choice. That universal task was the main ministry that Jesus was already doing inside. Kind of rest of it, all those even teachings, in a way, feels like, for the moment. People ask him questions. His heart is moved. He has to give them teaching. There are sick people in front of him. He has to cure them. He was living how love's supposed to live. But in his reality, in God's reality, that's what he was doing. So when we're talking about God's time and human time, well, is there God's reality and human reality, are they so much different? Some religion says yes, some religion says no. And we are on the side that trying to say no. Because we live in God's time. Matter is either we really are conscious of it. The problem of Jesus' brothers in this book is not so much about they didn't know what was going on. They're not really consciously understanding what Jesus was saying and doing. They were simply seeing it and understanding the way that fits what they think right. So if there's a condition that would enable us to enter into God's time or God's reality, according to today's teaching from the scripture, it is somehow putting down our pride. Belief that, hey, I know this. I can resolve this. I can fix this. Kind of putting it down. And see how God is leading you. And have faith. God will never lead you in a bad direction. The promise that I am reading over and over again, and I'm believing in, and I believe I am living in there, is that when we fully follow God's leading, the end result is always good. It may not be good at the moment, or it may not be so pleasant at the moment, but the end result is always good. And above all, you feel relieved because you don't have to carry the burden. The pride that we have against God has been a problem to many humans since the beginning. So, may God bless you all in your journey, but at the same time, in your willingness to accept and acknowledge you are living in God's time, and that should be much more real to you than the time that you think have, because we don't possess time. Amen.